ground control to Major Tom, your circuit's dead. There's something wrong. Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear? Am I floating? Am I sinking?
Greetings, programs. This is a
special episode of Parks and Recreation. I'm your co-host, Doug.
I'm your co-host, Brandon.
And today we are covering the science behind the film The Martian that just came out. And we have a special guest with us. If you want to introduce yourself, Dad.
Yes, my name is Bob. I'm Doug's dad.
And if you've listened to our show before, my dad guested on the computer episode. But I brought him back for another reason, specifically for this movie. You wanted to talk a little bit about your Mars bona fides?
Back in 1968, I had a summer job at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I actually worked on some of the instrumentation on the Mars Viking lander.
What stuff specifically did you work on?
What I worked on was there's an instrument called a gas chromatograph. And what the gas chromatograph does is they were going to take a piece of soil and then heat it up to a point where gases come off. And what a gas chromatograph does is the gas flows through this very, very thin tubing that has a special coating on it, and the different components of that gas separate at different rates through that coating. And at the other end of that, there is an analyzer that analyzes the gas coming out, and it creates a diagram on a graph. It's almost like a fingerprint in a way. Each chemical compound or each chemical like different groups that you find on atoms, especially organic ones, have very specific signatures. It's almost like light spectra, if you're familiar with that. Certain elements give off certain wavelengths of light. Well, with a gas chromatograph, they can look at the chemical compounds that come off of the soil and then from that try to figure out what they started with. And
It tells you what the Martian soil is made of.
To some extent, it's not exact. It's not an exact science, but it certainly gives them a good idea.
And it's not exact science, but it's pretty good science.
It's very good science.
Yeah.
Yes.
And were you on the design phase, right?
I wasn't there when they. I was way before they launched it. What I worked on, they were looking for two things that I worked on. One was how do you coat an extremely fine diameter of tubing. We're talking about tubing. It's thicker than a human hair, but not much, because it has to be lightweight, and you have to be able to find a coating that can survive, traveling through space, and it also has to get the job done. So we were looking at different coatings. My background is in chemical engineering, so that has to do with ways fluid flows and how things will work with the coating. And the other thing they asked me to figure out is, in order to make the material flow through the chromatograph, they use something called a carrier gas, and they use an inert gas. In this case, they use helium. And what they had on that Viking lander was they had a tank or a little cylinder of helium that was under pressure, and the idea was to get that all the way to Mars sealed in this tank, and then once they were ready to do the experiment with the gas chromatograph, be able to break that seal with an extremely low amount of energy, because they couldn't carry a lot of power on the thing. So they had to find, they couldn't turn a valve to open the seal. What they were looking for is something, because you only have to open it once, you don't have to seal it back up again. So the idea was to come up with some kind of membrane that would seal the gas in and hold the pressure in, and then be able, with a very low amount of power, break that membrane and start the gas flowing.
And your job was to help design that.
To figure out what kind of material to use for that. It was pretty interesting, because the way I approached it was to look at a metallic seal. We were looking at metals that had a fairly low melting point, but a high electrical resistance. So the idea is, if you could pass a current through it, a fairly low voltage current, if it has high resistance, it will generate some heat. And of course, it then has to have a low melting point. So we were looking for, we went through the whole periodic table and looked at all different elements and what their thermal conductivity was and their electrical resistance.
So if you zap it with just a little bit of electricity, the thing would come apart.
Yeah, we were taking, it was amazing because Jet Propulsion Lab in those days had plenty of money and we were getting some fairly exotic materials.
So this is 1 year before we landed on the moon, right?
Right, this was in 1968. And they were getting me, I was getting foil made out of rare earth metals and things like that because it looks like lutetium, for example, had a very good profile for that. And in a few days, they had lutetium foil for me to work with. And it turned out, at least when I left the project, I think we were actually focusing on a metal called indium, which is not a rare earth metal, but does have a low melting point, not as low as obviously as lead or mercury, but fairly low, and enough electrical resistance to generate the heat to melt it. One thing I don't know is whether anything I ever worked on actually flew on the Viking lander, because I only worked there for the summer, and they never followed up with me to let me know what finally was done. But,
well, I think that's an important point, though, when it comes to this particular movie, and especially the book that it's based on. Dad, you and I have both read the book. I know, Brandon, you just saw the movie. You haven't read the book. But a lot of the story depends on those kinds of tiny details. And especially in the book, he talks about, the fabric they use to make the HAB module out of it. Or, I need a wire from this particular thing, but I need to now use it in an application that nobody ever thought of using it for. And he has to do the science to figure out, is this material going to work for that? And I thought that it was just sort of an interesting way to get into the minds of engineers, especially because the movie helps with this as well, but you can see what a large team it takes to actually run a mission like this. So when he's all out on his own, he doesn't have the benefit of the guys who run this kind of, whether it's chemical analysis, they want to do the physics on these things, they want to do this, and he's got a botany background and some engineering know-how. And he has to do that all mostly on his own. So with that, I kind of figured we would just talk about some of the different things in the movie. Brandon, you want to start with any key moments in the movie that you want to talk about the science? Or,
well, is it even possible to grow anything on Mars, as like what he did?
You mean grow potatoes?
Yeah.
I did some research on this before, and I've seen about 50% of the scientists think it is possible to grow stuff in Martian soil, and about 50% think you can't do it. But Martian soil isn't anything like Earth soil. It's more like the moon soil than it is here. But part of it is the dirt that we have here on Earth has been shaped by billions of years of two things Mars doesn't have a lot of: water and life. So plants rely, for example, on a lot of nitrogen. That's an element that is extremely common. It makes up about 75% of it. And there's really very little of it on Mars at all. Certainly almost none in Mars's atmosphere. And if there's any in the soil, it's locked up in, it's nitrogen bonded to something else. So it's not the kind of, it's not in the format that plants can use. So I don't know that transplanting human feces into Martian soil would get you enough to allow plants to grow. And the other thing is that we've sent several landers, my dad talked about, to examine the soil. And I remember, I think it was the Phoenix lander that it was a probe that landed in near the Martian North Pole. When it dug in, it found element or chemicals called perchlorates. Trace amounts of things like that. These are kinds of things that are found in bleach. So Martian soil isn't exactly friendly to life. So I don't know the answer to that. Could you actually do what he did and manage to grow potatoes?
That's a tough one. To some extent, the soil provides the nutrients, but the main things that photosynthesis is based on are carbon dioxide, water, and light. And
Mars does have all three of those.
And what he did in the HAB, he provided all three of those. And to some extent, the soil does offer, is used to pick up certain of the trace elements that you, but I don't think Martian soil is, there is some nasty stuff in it, but it's probably a lot like Earth in the sense that I don't think you can generalize that the entire planet has soil like that. I think they can, it's like there's soil here in the desert that you can't really, it doesn't do well, and there's other parts where things do very well. The other thing that they found, here on Earth is that life is amazingly adaptable to extreme situations. They have found life on the bottom of the ocean at what these things called thermal vents that are living in the temperatures of boiling water.
That's true.
So, you know,
it also depends on what you want to grow, too.
Yeah.
Because some plants are going to be hardier than others. So I don't know that a potato plant has the durability to do this particular job, but another plant on Earth might be able to hack it. The other odd thing, if you look at soil like that under a microscope, I certainly know this is true for the moon. I don't know if it's true for Mars, but lunar soil is very jagged. Our soil has been kind of worn smooth by years of erosion that aren't really necessarily going on the same way on Mars or on the moon. So it can be particularly nasty just from forget the chemical makeup, but the physical makeup of it. It's really kind of unforgiving and harsh.
Oh, yeah, but that wouldn't affect plants growing.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I think it would affect, it would be extremely abrasive and, you know, very dangerous to handle. It'd be like handling little shards of broken glass.
Well, that might be one thing of just having it. I mean, he has it inside of his habitat, so he might be able to grow plants in it, but he could be cutting his lungs to shreds while he's inhaling it. Day in and day out. So that could be a problem as well. I think if we were to do a mission like that, if you had to survive, you might want to try and, I don't know, we didn't get a great sense in the film of how big the hab is or, you know, how it's laid out. There might be one room or something you could section off to grow potatoes in, and you try and keep that isolated so you don't spend a lot of time breathing in Martian dust. Obviously, he wouldn't have survived without that. That was a critical part of it. And we had to believe it was possible. And there is, like I said, about half of the stuff I read seemed to suggest it was possible to do. So, any other parts of it you had questions
about? I mean,
it's
true you can make water, right? But
absolutely.
Don't you need a lot of energy for that?
Well, you need fire.
You need the right ingredients.
You
need either fire. Well, you don't necessarily have an open flame, but you need some kind of chemical reaction that will produce water as one of its...
Right. And he started with essentially, you know, what I need for water. Water is H2O. It's two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. So all you need essentially to make this happen is something else with hydrogen in it and something with oxygen in it. And if you can get the two to react and you get H2O at the end of the reaction, you're good. That doesn't mean you can necessarily easily do it with any two compounds that happen to contain those two elements. You got to have the right ones. But he's got a couple of things working for him. He's got free O2, which is the oxygen that we breathe every day. It's two oxygen atoms stuck together just in the hab because he needs that to live. He's also got carbon dioxide, which is two oxygen atoms stuck to a carbon atom. So those are both good sources of oxygen potentially. And then what he ends up using for hydrogen is hydrazine, which is rocket fuel. This is a normal when rockets burn on Earth. You see that huge cloud behind them. A lot of that is water vapor. When you burn fuel... water is a very common byproduct. In fact, when you see sometimes you'll see dripping coming out of an exhaust pipe. What happens is there's water that is coming through your engine, just in your car, and at the end of the day, some of it condenses out in there, and at night it will drip out.
You see it also in the jet engines, back of planes that kind of go on a contrail. Same thing. It's
right,
water vapor.
Those two lines coming out. So it is a good way to make water. It's just as he sort of talks about in the movie, you saw him blow himself up. It's dangerous because you have the atoms together in a molecule, the way they hold together, that's energy. It takes energy to break them apart. And sometimes when you break them apart, the energy that's holding them together gets released. That's the explosion. So, and in fact, that's what you want with rocket fuel. You want that explosion because that explosion is what pushes you through space. But having it inside an enclosed room is not so ideal.
Yeah, it's a bomb.
it's a bomb. But that's how he's doing it. And in the book, he gets into a little more detail about, well, I've got this amount of rocket fuel, and how much water can I make with that? Is that enough water to do the job of irrigating these plants? And it's a very long and involved process that they kind of use some montage and stuff to give you the idea of like, okay, he figured it out. He's got it. He's good. But in the book, it's a little more of a constant back-and-forth battle, and and like he says, everything is designed not to burn because fires in space are extremely dangerous. There have been several astronauts through the history of space program who have died because of fires where they shouldn't be. So that's working against them as well. Do you want to talk about the storm a little bit? Because I think that was one of the few things that the science is a little wonky on.
We've seen on the internet and pretty much, you know, I would agree with, is the fact that the whole premise of the movie of why he gets stranded there is a little bit weak because of the fact that the atmosphere on Mars is so thin.
It's about 1/100th the thickness of Earth's atmosphere.
Right, so that even though you might have winds of 175 miles an hour, they wouldn't, just by straight physics, they wouldn't really exert that much force to be able to, say, tip over that, was it the MAV? Couldn't have tipped that over, and it wouldn't have taken that antenna and it blown it that way and impaled him and all that. So that part of it is a little bit, you know, of a stretch.
You basically have to presume that those items were already weakened somehow to begin with. But even then, the force of the Martian atmosphere, I mean, it kicks up a lot of very fine dust. It makes it hard to see, but it's not enough to actually push you over. It's incredibly weak.
Right, that's correct. But once you take that premise and you say, okay, that's how they wanted to strand him on Mars, the rest of it was actually, you know, pretty well done. The fact that Doug and I have read the book, what I will say is there are a lot more details that obviously you can't fit in a 2.5-hour movie or would be very boring for the general public to listen to. And
about 2/3 of the book is written from Mark Watney's point of view as he's explaining, like sort of in those logs, you see what he's doing. And so it's him telling you, okay, I'm measuring this, I'm adjusting that, which doesn't really work cinematically. It's hard to have a guy just sit there and talk through a math problem. But in the book, it's actually very harrowing because you start to realize, oh, wow, he really doesn't have enough resources to do what he has to do to live. So he's got to engineer some way around it. And it works really well. It makes things very intense. But that's kind of the fun of it, is sort of seeing the science in action. Is there another...
One thing that doesn't really have to do much with Mars, but the ship that they were on?
The Hermes.
The big one.
Right.
That one was... How big was that? Because that thing was massive.
Yeah, in the book it's described as being the largest, most expensive thing, man-made thing. Not the largest, but the most expensive thing man has ever built. But it's not clear how big it's exactly supposed to be. I imagine if you were, you know, a nerd who was inclined to do it, you could freeze frame it and say, like, all right, there's a person next to this thing. We know the person's got to be about 6 feet tall. So from there, you can extrapolate
to
how
big. It's as big as the Empire State Building or something.
Yeah, it can't be. I mean, it looks big, but it looks like maybe a little bigger than the International Space Station. These things can't be too large.
How big is it? I don't know how big that is.
Oh, wow. It's not very large. It's, you know, maybe...
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head either, but it's not... It's a few, like, capsules combined. So there's a little room to move in it, but if you were to have to live in there for... Like they did in the movie, they have to live in this thing for months and months and months. It's cramped. I mean, you'd go a little stir-crazy. Especially because the hallways are very narrow and stuff. But what it has to be able to do is it has to be able to support people's... support life, and it has to be able to move to get to Mars. And if you saw... in one of the scenes, you can see this kind of blue flame coming out the back of it. It's using what's called an ion thruster. And we talked about this a little bit with the Pluto episode because the same technology was used to get New Horizons to Pluto. And the way it works is they've got a gas called xenon. And the thing uses a small amount of electric current, and the current causes like a few xenon atoms at a time to go out the back of it. But if you push something out the back, there's an equal and opposite reaction that pushes the ship forward a little bit. Now, the amount of thrust is really tiny, but in space, there's no wind resistance. So as long as you keep pushing and pushing and pushing a little bit over time, you can actually accelerate to very high speeds without having to expend a lot of energy to do it. You just have to be willing to be patient and wait for the acceleration. And that's exactly what this thing in the movie does. It's the same thing. It accelerates on its way to Mars by doing that.
Yeah, they're already doing work with what they call solar sails. Actually, light even has a small amount of pressure, the photons that are emitted from the sun. And they're actually looking at ways of creating very large, like we used to sail the oceans in sailboats, you know, sails that they could extend that might be miles wide that would get a little bit of pressure from sunlight, but it never ends. The sunlight pressure is 24 hours a day. and it goes nonstop. And that after a while, you could get things going much faster than rockets could ever take them. But it would take a very long time to get them to that speed. But eventually, they'd be going at really large speeds.
Right. As long as you're willing to be patient, you get there. And in fact, in some ways, you can get to places, I mean, even faster than you would expect. I mean, people are talking about if we ever want to try and go to another star, it's going to have to be something like this, because conventional chemical rockets just can't generate the kind of thrust. In fact, they're so inefficient. That was one of the things that came up in the movie, right? Like we sent a rocket to try and send Mark Watney supplies, and the thing blew up, and they went, oh, we don't have any. We're out of rockets now. We used our one rocket.
Yeah, they cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and take a long time to construct and all that.
Right, so we had to borrow one from China. And unfortunately, all the ones we used to have, like the for the use of the Apollo program, they're all scrapped now.
Yeah.
And frankly, you don't want to have, I mean, we can try and refurbish them, but look, these things were built in the 60s. So, you know, do you want to have a giant bomb that was built 50 years ago carrying things into space?
Now, one thing in the movie that I thought was kind of off is, wouldn't he die from deficiency of nutrients from just eating potatoes for a year?
That actually does come up in the book, too. And what they have him do is, in the book, is he's got all of these vitamin pills to kind of fill up the gap, essentially, in his dietary needs. And the potatoes are just for pure calorie because they're carbs. And carbohydrates are molecules that your body breaks down into sugar fairly easily. So they're really good for energy. And as long as you're using the energy, then you burn it up and you're good to go. If you don't use that energy, that's why carbs make you fat, is that most of us will just eat that carbolicious thing and then not go for a 2-mile run. And so that sugar doesn't get used and it gets turned into fat. But so that's what he's using to kind of fill in the gap in his diet. It's enough to keep him alive. But you're right. Without, you know, all the other kinds of vitamins the body needs, you would start having scurvy and like all kinds of horrible things. But that's how they account for it in the book, and it's sort of assumed in the movie that he has the supply of vitamins to kind of take care of that problem. But that's a real big thing in the book, is obviously his food supply. And the first thing he does is calculate out, all right, there's so many meals. There's supposed to be 6 astronauts. I'm only one guy, so I have 6 times the food. It'll last 6 times as long. And Mars is a giant freezer, so it's not. And it's net, if you put something outside on Mars, it won't biodegrade. Like there's no bacteria to eat it up and make it rot. There's only there's kinds of like nasty solar radiation that comes down to Mars, but that wouldn't cause a problem in the short term for his food supply if you left that there. In fact, what he does in the book is after he's done with all the potatoes that he's made, he puts them outside. Just in empty Martian atmosphere, so that way they're, you know, freeze dried immediately, and he just as he needs them, he brings them in one by one. So the other thing I wanted to kind of touch on, I thought was an interesting thing that came up in the book that I think a lot of people watching the movie probably don't understand, is what hexadecimals are.
Oh,
because he uses that to communicate. He talks about, oh, I can't put 26 letters around Pathfinder because there's too many. I won't be able to tell exactly what letter they're trying to do. So he does hexadecimals. So if you want to give a little explanation of what that is?
Yeah, hexadecimals, it's basically numbers. If our usual system that we're used to counting by is what they call base 10 numbers. So when you get up to 9, then it becomes a 1 and a 0, and then you count up from there. Hexadecimal is, instead of being based on 10, it's based on the number 16. So after, when you get up to 9, and then you get up to then the next, you have A, B, and then 0, then you go to A, B, C, D, E, and F. So, for example, 0F in hexadecimal is really the number 15. 10 in hexadecimal is the number 16. In other words, when you hit F, you start, you put a 1 in the next place and start with 0 again, count up. And what they did years and years ago, when I started with computers and they used punch cards, was they came up with what was called the ASCII system. It's ASCII. It stands for American Society of Computer something. I don't remember exactly what it stands for. But each character that you in the alphabet has an ASCII value, and they actually start somewhere around 32, because starting with 0, 1 are funny characters like tab and backspace and carriage return and line feed and things like that. But every character has an ASCII value, and they go up to, well, they used to go up to, I believe, 255. Now they actually go beyond that because they use them for foreign characters and things like that. It's called a Unicode system. But you can represent a character, I believe, like an A is 65. That's an uppercase A, I think, is 65. There's also one for a lowercase a, I think, I think a quote is 34. I don't remember them off the top of my head. But once you have a number, you can then express it as a hexadecimal number. So that lets you use fewer characters. So like what he did was he took those 16 possible characters, 0 through F, and put them around. And then from that,
you could decode it.
You could decode it if somebody knew exactly what he was trying to do. And that's what he did. The movie, as Doug mentioned, left out, you know, some steps in between that where he had a wheel on the Pathfinder that he was rotating. And
oh, that was one thing. He took them. So if you remember, there's the Little Rover too, right?
Yeah.
That was the Sojourner Rover. And Pathfinder, when it landed, the Viking one that my dad worked on, were stationary landers. They landed in one spot, but
they took pictures.
And they measured things in the immediate area, but they couldn't move around anywhere. So when NASA was finally ready to go back to Mars and land something in the 90s, they said, well, we want to be able to move around a little bit. So what they did was they landed the Pathfinder, which was the big part of it, and on top of that was this little rover. And so the big one was kind of home base, and then the little rover would drive around here and there. It was called Sojourner. And in the book, what he does is he takes Sojourner and he writes the hexadecimal letters on the wheels. And so what he's able to do is tell them, rotate the wheel until that letter comes into view, and using that, he's able to communicate with them for a little while. In fact, there's a bunch of different communication methods. Another one they use is in the book, this didn't happen in the movie, but in the book, he ends up accidentally zapping Pathfinder, ruining its electronics, and he cuts off his communication to Earth. And he doesn't have any way to communicate with them anymore, or really them with him. So what he starts doing is leaving rocks out in large enough patterns that the satellite overhead can see them, and he leaves them in a Morse code message. You know what Morse code is?
A little bit, but not much.
It was developed by Samuel Morse, in the 1800s.
1800s, when they first invented the telegraph, all they could do was send out little beeps. And what he did was came up with the idea of dots and dashes, a little short dip or doop, you know, back. And each letter of the alphabet had a certain set of dots and dashes. And that's how, they would take a little key, a little thing on a spring that made contact, and they would train people as telegraph operators because that's how they could transmit messages at the speed of light. This is in the 1800s, and the only electricity they had in those days was battery-generated electricity, like dry cells, that they had invented, chemical batteries, basically. And they could transmit a message from, say, New York all the way to, say, Washington, D.C. or Chicago. It had to go over a copper wire, but on the other end, they could send these dots and dashes, and the person on the other end who was trained in listening to them, could translate them back into letters and then, into words and sentences. And that's how they communicated. Even the military used it for years. As a matter of fact, to this day, I think, certainly in the Navy, I think the people are actually trained to use this code.
Because every once in a while, there might be a situation where all you have to communicate is, maybe something as simple as on a binary form of communication. It's either on or it's off. And switching things on and off fast enough can allow you to communicate that way.
And before that, and with ships, what they did, because obviously you didn't have a copper wire later on, was it was called a heliograph. It was light. They would use flash. They'd have a thing that would flash light as either short, a dot, or a longer period of time. So dots and dashes. And again, Morse code was what they used to communicate things.
Right. There was another thing that happened in the book that they did not do in the movie, but I thought was interesting. They talked about his power supply a lot. Mm-hmm. And he's got solar cells. But solar cells on Mars are slightly different in that Mars is a lot farther away from the sun, so therefore less sunlight. In fact, it propagates, I think it's 1 to 4, right?
I think it's about 30 or 40% of what we get here.
Right. So if you go, if you go twice the distance from the sun, you don't get half the sunlight. You get four times as much less. You get a fourth of the sunlight. And the reason is light is spreading out in all directions at once, right? So instead of getting half, it's getting thinner and thinner and thinner. So that's the way it kind of spreads out. So when he's doing his math about how much power do I have, there's a whole thing in the book where he's got to bring all of these solar cells with him. And how can I get enough of, you know, where's enough room on this rover to get enough solar panels to power this thing and keep me warm so I don't freeze to death? He actually engineers some platforms that he builds onto the rover to allow for more solar cells. Can you explain a little bit how photovoltaic cells work?
Well, I can't, not entirely. There is a, in physics, there is something called a photovoltaic effect. They use very thin wafers of silicon, but how it actually works, I'm not sure, but I think what happens is that when sunlight hits the top layer of that, it somehow dislodges electrons from the lower layers, and they somehow manage to capture that and generate, it's a very small amount of electrical current, but it can be stored up and you can use it to slowly charge a battery. That's how nowadays you see a lot of these solar lights on people in people's yards, and a solar cell just really charges a tiny rechargeable battery. And then when it gets dark, it switches on and you get a little bit of light for one day's worth, and then the next day it has to charge again.
Right. And I think they kind of touch on how cold Mars is in the movie, but not really. The Mars is, on a good warm day, is like Antarctica here on Earth. It's about
really?
That cold. Yeah. And it's also, well, it kind of depends on how you measure it, because the dirt itself, the soil on Mars on a good day can get up to about 70 degrees. But because the atmosphere is so thin, if you take that thermometer off the ground and move it up, you know, a centimeter away from the ground, now you're at, you know, minus 100, because there's no water in the atmosphere, there's no air, nothing to retain that heat. So yes, the ground is warm, but it just radiates away immediately.
Wow.
So that's why he's in the rover and he's like, breathe, you know, you can see the glass and he's like, I can't take it. I have to go back. I can't handle it anymore. So that's a real conundrum for him because he needs enough energy to make the rover go, and also enough to heat him. And he realizes he can't really easily do both at the same time. That's why he digs up that plutonium battery.
What was that used for? Like before the plutonium battery?
Well, they've used that on several space probes. The good thing about radioactive material is it by itself it just generates heat. And plutonium has a very long half-life, so you can use a very small amount of it. I know they used it on the Cassini probe to Saturn.
New Horizons.
And what they can do is it will generate electricity and heat. As a matter of fact, in the book, he actually has a problem when he first starts using it to get heat. It's giving him too much heat, and he's, you know, sweating from all the heat it's generating inside the rover.
And it's shielded. By the way, it is shielded against radiation. If you thought that maybe he would, you know, just give himself cancer from the thing. The idea is that it is shielded enough that the heat can get out, but not the radioactive particles coming off of the plutonium itself.
Yeah.
But that's what it's for. What was it originally for? I think in the book he said it was part of their descent vehicle. That when they originally land on the planet, their job was to then take this thing, as, you know, 4 miles away from their landing site and then bury it just in case anything were to happen to it. But a lot of the book is him finding ways, in the movie, is finding ways to repurpose things he already has. He goes, all right, well, I need some way to store water. Oh, I could take one of these spacesuits that is, you know, extra that no one's using. I can fill it with water. He finds all kinds of ways to, you know, take materials and repurpose them like that throughout the movie. Is there another part of the movie you had a question about? So maybe an event in there that was...
Well, like that, the thing he was driving
the rover.
How fast was that going? Because he was going a long distance, like.
Yeah, in the book they kind of spend more time, and here they kind of yada yada yada. And it was like, okay, so he leaves, and then he's 3,000 kilometers away. He makes it there. The book obviously deals with him encountering a few more problems along the way getting there, but I think they actually do the math, and they say he can drive on a good day about 80 kilometers.
And how far is that in
miles?
About 5 miles, 50 miles.
It's about 50 miles a day he can get out of it, and he needs to go several thousand miles to get there.
Wow.
It's like a cross-country drive.
Right.
And will he take his whole set of things
to
there?
Well, he needs to. Yeah, that was another thing that he starts working out is there's two different kinds of oxygen replacement systems. They refer to it a few times in the movie. They call it the oxygenator. And what that is a machine that takes the carbon dioxide in Mars's atmosphere, splits off the carbon part, and here's your two oxygen atoms so you can breathe. But the thing is large, and he needs it. He can't just take it. If he takes it out of the HAB, well, then he has to live in the rover. So he has to figure out, all right, how do I take this thing with me? Because he's got a different oxygen system in the rover and in his spacesuits, which are oxygen filters. And NASA's been using them for years. It's basically a kind of a wafer-like material, I think, that absorbs CO2.
No, yeah,
right?
It's not an oxygen. It's a carbon dioxide absorber. It probably has a lot of things in it, like activated charcoal.
And carbon dioxide, and they mentioned this in the book too, is a real problem. And carbon dioxide, the air we breathe, we only, maybe what, 20% of our atmosphere is oxygen. We need that to live. Most of it, as we said before, is nitrogen. That doesn't do anything. It just kind of goes into our lungs and out, and nothing happens. Carbon dioxide too much carbon dioxide, you'll pass out, and it doesn't take a lot. In our atmosphere, carbon dioxide is at 400 parts per million. But if it was up to 1%, that would be enough to make you pass out.
Really?
So that's why he needs these. It's not just enough to get oxygen in for him to breathe. He needs to get carbon dioxide out because it's physically harmful. So he can take all of these filters that take carbon dioxide out of the air, but they don't give him new oxygen to breathe. The only way he can do that is with this particular machine that he needs to keep running. But that's how he does it. There's a catalyst in there that just strips the carbon atoms away. So that's how he's and if you saw, they had this big balloon come out of the top of the rover. They saw him design that. Part of that was he needed more room because the oxygenator was actually so large it couldn't really fit inside the rover. It was never designed to be part of the rover. So he had to take it along with him. So does that kind of explain how he has enough oxygen to live? Yeah, it's the only way, and it's the only, you talk about the oxygenator, the water reclaimer, which is basically a thing that takes water and whatever else is in it, say urine, boils it.
Just so the water is water and nothing else.
Right, all the stuff that's not water doesn't turn into steam, and you just eject it or get rid of it. Another interesting thing, I thought that this wasn't even in the book, as I recall, but if you remember, he has to get some manure to fertilize his potatoes. You saw it was all in little packages.
And it was, like, crusty, too.
Well, that's because all of the water immediately is, with no atmosphere, the water boils away.
Oh, really?
That's why Mars is so dry, because it takes atmospheric pressure to keep water liquid. When you take the pressure away, the water turns into a gas, because you have to physically push all of them, the water molecules down into a liquid substance. That's what the pressure does. But like we said before, Mars has a hundredth the atmospheric pressure of Earth, so it's not enough. So that's why it was all crusty. The water was just gone from it. But it's also important that we, and now more important than ever, that now that we know that there is liquid water in places on Mars, they're starting to get really concerned of like, well, what if we send stuff to Mars and Earth bacteria comes along with it? Now we have, if there is any indigenous Martian life, we don't want to ruin it by introducing an Earth bacteria that
kill it or anything.
Well, it multiplies and messes with the Martian ecosystem, yeah. So that's why those bags were sealed. There wasn't a detail I remember from the book, but it is something NASA's concerned with. They when they build the probe, they build the probe in what's called a clean room. And if you go to JPL, you can see it. In fact, JPL has an open house next weekend. If you're listening to this, was it October 9th and 10th, I think, is next weekend? If you're in the Pasadena area or anywhere in Southern California, you can go up and for free, you can tour JPL and see all of the stuff, all the probes and how they make these things and the facilities they use to test them. And I actually went to this thing a few years ago, and that was when they were building the Curiosity rover, which is the current big rover that's there now. And it was in this white room that was super sterile. And you might ask, like, well, why do we need to keep it so sterile? Because it's just going to be out in space. Like, you're not going to get the probe sick. But the key is we want to make sure we don't want to send anything to Mars to mess with it, because we're so hopeful that maybe someday we will find life there that we wouldn't want to, it would be horrible if we got to Mars and the only life we find turns out to be life we accidentally brought from Earth. So that would ruin us. That's why they do that. In fact, you kind of saw that white room a little bit when they were assembling some of the stuff in the mission and during that montage. You saw the capsule that was supposed to send him all of his.
Yeah, it was very white.
Right. That room, that if it wasn't the real thing, it sure looked a lot like it, that room. So, any other topics you want to cover? We're running out a little out on time. But something else that you thought was interesting? Maybe the maneuver at the end or stuff like that?
Well, yeah, like, what did they do at the end? Because it kind of confused me a little bit. Why they had to blow something up to...
Oh, okay. So the issue is you've got to... doing orbital maneuvers, like when you saw them first, they sent that supply probe and they had to go and get it. It's like trying to shoot a bullet at another bullet and hit it out of the sky, right? Because those probes and the ship are moving at an enormous speed. It doesn't look like it because it's kind of sitting there and you don't have a frame of reference, but those things are moving at tens of thousands of miles an hour. So he's going to launch this vehicle off of the planet, and he has to meet up with them. He has to be in. He doesn't have any real control over it after a certain point because they said it wasn't designed to go that far, right? It was designed to be picked up at a much lower orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So to get it that far, they had to use all the fuel. So once you use all the fuel, he doesn't have any ability to make course corrections or adjustments or do anything. Now he's just he's a projectile just mm-hmm. flying through space. So the issue they had was, all right, he's going to be, you know, we're not going to be there when he's going to be there. We're going to be 68 kilometers away, so we need to go faster. So they go, okay, so we're going to fire all of our rockets to go faster and be there to meet him. They go, okay, great. Now we're going to be there when he's there. The problem is we're going to be going so fast that we won't be able to catch him. So they had to slow, once they had to get up fast enough to be within range, now they had to slow down so they would be able to intercept him.
And the thing, and that big ship only had those ion engines, which are very gradual.
It'll get you from Mars to Earth.
Right. You can't give it a quick blast. So the way they gave it a quick blast was to have blow the airlock, and then when all the air rushes out, it actually is for a very short period of time, almost like a rocket engine, not quite. But it gives it that force.
And this is just, again, Newton's basic laws. An object in motion stays in motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So when that air pushes forward, it also pushes backward on the ship. So that allowed it to act as a brake, and it was able to slow down enough to where they were able to grab him and bring him back in.
And then the last thing I have to say is, why did he have to, like, empty out his little capsule?
Oh, because they needed him to get, again, the ship was designed to be intercepted at what's called low Mars orbit, way down here. But the problem is, the way they did that maneuver, the ship was going to be at a much higher altitude. So what they had to do is make the thing go faster and farther. So the only way you can do that is, well, let's remove the weight, because we can't make the thing have any more thrust, right? The amount of thrust it has is fixed, because it's got certain engines, and it's got a certain amount of fuel, and that's all they're ever going to get. So another Newton's, I can't remember if it's 1, 2, or 3, but force equals mass times acceleration is another one of Newton's laws. So if you want to accelerate mass, it's going to take a certain amount of force. The more mass you have and the harder you want to accelerate it, the more force you need. So if you know you've only got a fixed amount of force and a speed you want to get to, all you can do is reduce the mass to get the result you want. So that's what he was doing. He's reducing the left. You know, we don't need the instruments. You're not piloting it. You don't need the extra chairs. You don't need the nose cone. You don't need any of this stuff.
Don't you need the nose cone though to fly?
No, what they said was you need the nose cone for something else.
Well, to maintain pressure, but he said he was only but he was in his spacesuit, and the whole flight was only going to be 12 minutes. So he had enough oxygen in his spacesuit. So he really didn't have to be in an enclosed.
Right, and they talk about wind resistance isn't a huge problem because Mars's atmosphere is so thin. Now it did end up creating enough of a problem that they had to make those adjustments by blasting the air out of the ship and all that, because the ship had a little bit of drag to it, and it wasn't quite where they wanted it to be. But the logic behind that was sound, which is, you know, this is all unnecessary weight. If all we need to do is just catapult this guy into orbit and grab him, we don't need the rest of this stuff. But that's why they did it. That's why they stripped it down to its bare bones, is because that way you have the same amount of force on less mass and therefore a greater acceleration. That we probably got to wrap it up, but I want to thank Dad. I want to thank you for coming in and talking about Mars. And a couple of quick announcements. Will be our next mainline episode is going to be on aviation. We'll hope to do that in a couple of weeks. We have a friend who's a fighter pilot who's going to come in and talk about that. So it'll be pretty cool. If you got questions on this topic, you want to send them in, go email them to quarksandrec@gmail.com, or you can tweet us @quarksandrec, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/quarksandrec, and you can find us there. And with that, I think we can call this one finished.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye.
City breaking the name.